This podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha.
Bonjour. So I feel really appreciative for Amy Rush's invitation to share a little with you today. I think this is a very special occasion this week. And upon arriving last night, it was really, you could really feel it in the space here, in the Zendo. Something is happening. And I'm also joyful to be here. I'm joyful for meeting old friends. I'm joyful for being with my Dharma sister and brothers and to be here with my teacher. I'm also joyful to be with you. Some people I know for some time, for long years. Some people I've even met in Auschwitz long ago. And I had the opportunity to share already some moments with you before. I do remember a workshop we did in Lisbon. On seeing and going to the museum together. I remember an evening in the Wildflower Zendo in Paris. Some of you I've met on Zoom, talking about a painting. So it's really nice to be here with you. Offering the incense, I noticed this Buddha, this Buddha statue. Is it yours, of your son, or? Well, anyway, I think it's really, it's the Buddha sitting there in his flower robe. It's full of flowers. And I think it's really appropriate for the wildflower. It's the wildflower Buddha. Sitting here with us. I think it's a beautiful notion, eh? The sense of wild flower. I mean, as if they're kind of, I don't know, tame flowers or educated flowers, but this is a wild flower, sharing its color and fragrance. Abundantly. As Amy Roshi said, and I think it's a really beautiful line, you know, right to the heart of our life. Abundantly sharing our colors and perfume. So it was also special to come back here, because last month we were here also with the Dana Sangha for Tanya's transmission. It was a great It was a great time because I came here. We had the retreat in Germany, 2 weeks with our Sangha from Belgium, and afterwards we came down from the Eifel region where we were. Actually, we were there right in the middle of the floodings. We were sitting sashin in a small village. It was really, it was bad weather, it was raining, and for long years we were going to each summer, going to a little village up in the valley near the Rhine. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of rain, and then even at one point at the end of the first week the electricity broke down, and there was water in the cellar, but we were on sashin. I was not so much on internet. We had no clue what was really going on around us. And then it became evident, that the villages across the hill, across the where the valley of the Ahr is, where those Ahrweiler, Bad Neuenahr, but totally, tens of people drowned houses. And it was so, when it became clear that we were really in the middle of this region that was hurt so much. Stan was with us, and we go and pick up the people from the train in Zinzig. So before the retreat, the first day, we pick the people up and we have a coffee there near the station, and the second week. But exactly that village, it's like 10 kilometers away, where we pick up the people. There, this thing happened, this home where these 15 handicapped people drowned because they could not be evacuated. So it was really very particular to sit in silence, knowing, what was our kind of getting a sense of what was going around. It was very particular. It was almost like surreal. But anyway, after the retreat, we came down by car through Trier and Metz, Nancy, to Burgundy here. And before coming to the retreat, we stayed at the camping nearby with the children. It was wonderful. It was the first time we camped. It was actually Dutch camping. It was full of Dutch people. but it was very pleasant. We had a wonderful view on the hills, and then there was the retreat. So after transmission, we stayed at another place near Autun for a couple of days. And Autun is very well known for its cathedral, its Romanesque cathedral. So eventually, after a lot of convincing my young daughters, we agreed to make a walk in the hills above Autun, and then afterwards go eat something in Autun. And Daddy had an idea to visit a little bit of the church because it's such a well-known, it's a masterpiece actually of Romanesque sculpture. So we had a really good afternoon, then we had pizza, and it was very sweet. We looked a little bit at the church, and I noticed my daughters are 13 and 11. They were really like into it, I thought. So Daddy was explaining about the Christ, this and the Last Judgment, the Dimpan of Autun, the people in the bosom of Abraham, good people, and then those who go to hell. And even those who saved from hell, you can really see it's very, this hand saving. But afterwards they told me that actually there was some people joining us to listening in, you know. I thought my daughters were really interested in, but they said, no, we were more like proud.
More like
proud.
Proud. Oh, okay.
But I had no clue, so we were all happy. And so we agreed to go for ice cream. But it was kind of already late. So the medieval city, the upper city, was all like everything was kind of closed. So we went down to the lower city, the 19th century park. And we couldn't find an ice cream place anymore. So we asked someone, he said, you know, I have a good friend, he has a shop, for sure he has. So this man brought us to the shop, and he had ice cream Ben and Jerry. Ben and Jerry. He had only like this big pot. Chocolate chip ice cream. So we walked with our pot, and you know, it has this beautiful Grand Place here, 19th century Grand Place with the Hôtel de Ville and the Lycée in the lower city, overlooking the valley of the Aru and the hills. And it was like 9 o'clock, you know, night was falling, the sun was setting, and we were sitting on the kiosk, I don't know the word in English, the kiosk, the music where they played
music.
Well, in the
gazebo.
Yeah, in the middle of the place there was this thing. So we were sitting with our Ben and Jerry pots, overlooking the Grand Place and the evening, eating Ben and Jerry. And I told my girls the story of the Ben and Jerry chocolate chip cookie ice cream. And you know, do you know this story about?
No.
Well, it's a what? But you, for sure, you know Bernie Roshi Glassman? That's a Ben Roshi, who designed this bakery, this mandala of engaged practice. And part of that was a bakery that he created for people to learn a job and to offer kind of income. This whole, you know, social enterprise that was organized along spiritual Zen principles, we could say. It's basically the mandala of the five Buddha energies. So he had the bakery, and in the early days they had their first big contract. They had this contract to make chocolate chips cookies for Ben and Jerry's. Huh? So it was a big thing, because Ben and Jerry's themselves had a kind of social policy in their business. And so the Greystone Bakery could work with them. So they made their first cooking. They made chocolate chip cookies. They were good, but now they could, on a regular basis, deliver to Ben and Jerry's with boost. So they make their cookies for them. They put them in the truck early morning to bring them to Ben and Jerry's. Upon opening the truck, taking out the cookies, they noticed that all the crispy cookies turned flat, you say? Turned kind of soft and humid. They made a mistake. They had no clue about transporting fresh cookies. So it needs actually a ventilation system in the truck so that the cookies don't get
melted
and, you know, like completely soft. So they were there with this investment of cookies, a truckload full of cookies, basically not being able to be used for the ice cream. And so the story goes, and Bernie Roshi, I think in his book, describes it in the book, was it?
Yeah, I can't remember that.
Well, they were sitting together, Ben, Jerry, and Bernie. Like, what to do?
Instruction to the cook.
Maybe it's in one of his books also, but he told the story often. So it was like a disaster. The first, you know, load, like everything turned bad. And then in the meeting, they kind of brainstormed, what can we do with this mistake? And they came up that day, that moment, with the idea to grind all the cookies and just put them in the ice cream. So that's what they decided to do. They all the cookies in the ice cream, and they distributed the ice cream to different places in New York as a tryout. Like, it was huge, the success. It was like the thing, suddenly. I mean, I read a couple of years ago that the chocolate chip cookies ice cream is the best sold product of Ben & Jerry's. So, just a story to say, I was telling my daughter, sitting on the kiosk, telling this nice story, how a disaster, because they know Bernie, or they have met Bernie before, how, you know, like a disaster can turn into an opportunity. And the second vow, delusions are, it's actually bono, the word in Chinese. Delusions are inexhaustible. It's like those things that frustrate us, don't work. Exactly there. No. So I was telling the story to Hanya and Sana and Alexandra eating the ice cream. It was nice. And suddenly, from over the houses, there was this group of birds coming over the marché, like hundreds, swallows. I mean, and it kind of filled the whole sky in the sunset. It was like magic. And we were still like, you know, recovering from our, oh, when a second wave of birds came. Like, and they flew over the Grand Marché, over the city, up to the hills above the town. And it turned, and it was like time stood still. It was such a magic moment. And it was just an ordinary evening. It was just a summer. These birds do migrate. The color of the sun setting is, you know, but it was like this whole moment, this moment where like everything falls like together in the right place, and I don't know. And the situation offers its colors and its fragments. So, really, afterwards I thought, what is it? What is it that this is? I mean, I don't know. It's a kind of how ordinary life shows itself in its depth and beauty and mystery. It's a mystery. But this morning early, I had to think, you know, I think I'm allowed, you know, in this week of preparation, the teacher and the teacher to be, the new teacher, together make like a drawing at one point. It's very simple. It's a line and another line crossing. intersecting. And in a way you could read it as two arrows meeting. No? But it's actually... And I was present when Amy Roshi and Joa were drawing the line, and I had suddenly to think on this Zen notion about intersecting. It's a metaphor that regularly in our liturgy, in our stories, comes back, like to the meeting. It's about meeting. I mean, we could look at our practice as a multitude of ways of really meeting oneself and oneself, to close the gap between oneself and to really meet with reality, to be really to meet with the other. So much about which makes me think of this beautiful exchange of young Tozan, Tungshan, Chinese master Tozan Ryokai. And I kind of forgot now the Japanese name, Tozan's teacher, but Jungyan in Chinese, Jungyan. Tozan trained with him, worked first. He trained with several teachers, but eventually with Jungyan, something crystallized, or and so Tozan is going to leave. He's going to go his own way as a young new teacher. And Jungyan is old. And before leaving, the old teacher says to the young man, "Shall we ever meet again?" And Tozan said, "Shall we ever not meet again?" He says, in a way, we will meet everywhere. This thing that we share will be even beyond. I mean, Tozan knew what he was, you know, Jungyan is going to die. It's maybe the last time. But the young teacher expresses, I mean, he realizes, I will meet him everywhere, even if we don't meet in person. Because it's also not only about the personal that is touched upon in this meeting. And I guess that is what brings us to practice. They have this in Chinese Buddhism, also in Chinese Zen Chan, they used an old Taoist notion called Kan Ying. Not Kuan Ying, but Kan Ying. And in Japanese it's translated as Kanno Doko. Kanno Doko. And Kanno Doko is an old Chinese term to, you know, the Chinese at one point in the early Middle Ages, they discovered a very particular thing in the physical world. So the Chinese were, they had the string instruments, these, I don't know the name, you know. Whenever you go to Chinese restaurants, you hear ping, ping, ping. Well, they built these string instruments long ago. And they noticed this very particular phenomenon. If you have an instrument in one room and you plug the string, another string instrument in the room next door, that same string starts to tremble, or how to say?
Vibrate.
So here, string, and somehow, without something that carries that energy, the other string resonates. Something resonates. And they noticed this, and they call this kanying, sympathetic resonance. And the Chinese used this notion to describe what happens when people, when things really meet. Something resonates. It's evident for a guitar to resonate, it needs a space for the sound. It needs an empty space. A guitar is basically an empty space with strings. If the guitar is filled with stuff, it won't resonate. Long ago I asked Kanarushi, you know, because in Buddhism and they talk so much about and Zen about the nature of mind. And, you know, I remember asking him Dokusong, sensei, because Roshi was sensei back then. You know, nature of mind. You know, what is it? And I can't remember exactly how Roshi responded, but there was definitely some things. She asked me to come back and to reflect on it. It was something like that. So, I was a little used to Quan practice, but this was kind of tough. I thought, what is the nature of mind? Well, and eventually, Roshi helped me out, and she spoke. I mean, it's clear you can't say what it is. It's not a thing. So you can't grasp it, you can't define it, you can't manipulate it. It's not a thing. So the first thing Roshi said about it, it's we call it empty. It's empty, it's open. It's open, it's fast, it's open. It's like the guitar, it has this quality of emptying itself out. And then, you know, empty and mind is also, we know when we're really open, we have this capacity to empathize, to resonate. So the nature of mind is also functioning. It's compassionate. It wants to do something from this sense of openness that connects. And the third one, and that's the kind of really like stayed with me, and it's empty, it's functioning, compassionate, and it's cognizant, it's aware. Our being, our mind, our heart-mind, by itself, it's its nature to be aware. We have as humans this capacity to see, hear, understand. which is beautiful, because that's why we can be in connection through being aware. So, like, you know, even thinking back on that moment on the kiosk in Utah, we were there together, we were just eating ice cream, there was not much going on, but then with the birds and the sun, it was like suddenly our capacity to perceive, to hear, because we could even hear them, was so opened up. And so this quality of kanodoko, sometimes translated as felt interresonance, resonance but interresonance, mutual resonance, and it's felt, kan. Kan means felt, feeling. And no means response. It's a felt response to do, truth, the way, ko, which is giving. So it's a felt exchange, intersection. Ko is also intersection. And this experience, because it's a human experience, became in our Zen practice, in our lineage, became like really like the heart of the practice between teacher and student. Where we meet, where we connect, where we learn to trust and to open up, where we trust to emptying oneself out so that something can mutually resonate. And I've seen it. As a young practitioner, I think Amy Roshi for me was helpful in that. To like understand, what is this? What is this relationship? You know? It's about absorbing, opening up to absorbing. In the end, you know, because we bring to the relationship so many things, we bring our longings and our desires and our shadows also. And, you know, in the beginning we want to make sure and we want to be seen and we want to, you know, we want to be loved. But eventually we more and more we realize that it's not so much that what we deeply long for. What we deeply long for is this meeting, this intimacy. And, you know, if I would describe in a way what, you know, on the having this ice cream at the family, it was an intimate moment. And also 2 weeks before, in the Eiffel, sitting there knowing so much suffering was going on around us was also an intimate moment. Very much. Celui qui sauve. Maybe a last thing, because this thing about the felt interresonance, which it's more like informative, but to me it's like really, it speaks to me a lot, because I struggled for long years with these, with our four vows at the end of the day, or sentient beings are numberless, I vow to, how do you chant that?
Say
that. Big job. It's like an impossible vow. It's really like a con, huh? And there are different approaches to it. But I was really, I was happy to hear that. But I was struck. I have a friend, a scholar, a Dutch scholar, who became a Zen teacher also. And who went several times to China, and one day we were talking about the vows, and he said he did some research in China about the origin, the five, six patriarch in the Zen tradition, but the vows are older. Huh? The Brahmanat Sutra is correct. Huh? But he was like investigating into the way the Chinese had translated these old vows from Indian. And he said something what spoke to me, the Chinese, the structure of the Chinese language is essentially different from the Indo-European languages, in the sense that they hardly use pronouns, for instance. And he said the way of reading the way it's in the oldest renditions of the vow, so is a little bit more like, sentient beings are numberless. Seeing that the sentient beings are numberless, being aware, because we sentient beings, it's like a fact. Mm-hmm. But the vow asks us to be aware, sentient beings that suffer are numberless. So the vow is more like being aware, seeing all those numbers of sentient beings, in me emerges, resonates the thing that I want to do something. So it's not so much I vow, I promise, I'm going to do this, but when I'm really open and I see and I'm aware of the sentient beings that suffer, it is in my nature that this arises. Seeing the numbers of delusions at the Bono, there are 108, they say, which is basically a number for numberless. Huh? Delusions are numberless. But really being aware of my delusions, in me emerges the desire to work with them. And that's the same sense, when I'm really open, something resonates in me. It's not of my doing even, it's in my nature, as a human being. Chikido, how about the time?
It's an hour.
Which means? Half an hour? So let's open up the space, as they say. Maybe someone wants to share something or say something. I don't know your name, but what's your name?
Krisha.
Okay, fine.
I'm not sure what I'm going to ask. There's a question here about the, I don't know how you call it, the inter-resignation.
Resonance.
Resonance.
The felt inter-resonance.
Felt inter-resonance. What I was thinking that resonates, and I have, experience with my Hashi that really interested, but the question is, when is with badness? When sometimes, without words, we meet someone in the dark,
mm-hmm.
and we feel it. It's a big energy. It has a lot of force, and you feel bad, and you feel that danger. I don't know if anybody felt this in their own, at the course of their lives. But sometimes when you meet, in my life, sometimes I had that experience that you haven't even talked, but you know that something wrong, dangerously wrong, you know? It's like you're resonating that.
Okay.
And that's that. And I was thinking while you were talking, well, but you can have that with love, you can have that seeing the delusion or resonating all that, but that's just rational. But in that moment, when you feel that, really feel the something's wrong.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do then?
I don't know.
There's
a question in here, but I don't know how to put it, you know?
Mm. Well, I don't know if I can answer the question for you, but I think it's a capacity we have to really... here I'm talking this felt inter-resonance. I was really bringing that into the context of, like life confirming things and good things.
Right.
But I think we have also sometimes the intuition to really feel like this is not right. This doesn't feel good, or I would kind of listen to it, like really listen to it, and what does it say, and what is the thing? And I think we sometimes really can feel that some things are not so good for us. I have felt that with people, what is more difficult, if I can say, is sometimes I relate to people and I'm not aware why the bonding is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that I've bonded with people who kind of confirm or make my neurosis stronger.
Mm-hmm.
That's it's like a match of two, and both of us, we get into this thing. And what I'm saying, that wasn't more dangerous in a way, because sometimes I didn't even notice, because it was so my own thing, it was so confirming my but I would say, if you have with people the sense of I would have trusted and then maybe investigate, but sometimes we're not sure. I had a small situation like that here, actually, in Magny, a month ago. We came here for a couple of days. It was at the end of the month, and normally we had announced and scheduled, and we had a contract to go on the retreat on the 31st of July, just across the border in Holland. And Zeeland. We go there since 15 years. Due to the corona, we had not much sign-ups. Because in my country, people are very, careful to meet still. But actually, we're doing quite well with the vaccinations. But we announced the retreat months ago, thinking that by the summer we could go on retreat, And then Holland turned red. Which means that actually the official line is you're strongly advised not to go to a red area, red region. So we're there with, you know, we had adults, we had children for the Children's Week. What to do? You know, what is it my responsibility to bring people to? So eventually I waited until the last moment, until the last Thursday. On Thursday, the European map is published. There you can see. So then eventually I called from here to say that we're not going to come. Because I felt like I don't want to take that responsibility to bring 30 people to, I understand it was short. It was 2 days before. For those people there who run the center, they had a hard time these last year and a half. They had hardly any groups. So the man was really disappointed. He was a little angry even, it's last notice, whatever. But I felt it's not right to go. I really felt it, that it's not right now to go. 4 days later, the wife of the owner calls me to say she is ill with corona. There. So they're all in quarantine, and the place we should have been, So then I thought maybe it's a good thing that sometimes we trust our intuition. So I would say trust your intuition and look what brings it to, or what keeps you in this kind of meeting. I don't know. Maybe some people are more...
What I feel, I don't know what is the question, but it's like, it's so magical and good when you bond in the trust, intimate way, but when you bond with something wrong, you are bonding, also, it's really intimate. But it doesn't feel magical.
No. But absolutely true. But it's, absolutely, absolutely. But maybe there is also, what I've noticed, that my capacity to be intimate with someone else is the same as my capacity to be intimate with myself. And so my capacity to bond with, difficult things outside me has something to see how much am I attached to bonding to those difficult things in myself. And I think there is a kind of parallel there. You see?
I'm thinking about it.
Good question. I will reflect more on it. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stefan.
It seems to me that what you call a resonance only really arises if there's stillness. If you have a busy mind, I have to do this and this, I want that and that, the resonance cannot arise. And so also the connection or the bonding of the little signals we receive that you did when you decided not to go. It can only be perceived if there is enough stillness that this little thing can actually be seen.
Absolutely. I mean, you use the word stillness. Another way of saying is emptying oneself out. Which is stillness, yeah, absolutely. Because it whispers in a soft voice. When there is a lot of noise, we don't hear the whisper telling us. That's why it's so, in our practice, so these moments of stillness and openness. Yes? What's your name?
Ulrike. I would like to continue with your question, the good and the bad. Here we practice to be good. And
is that so? Maybe I missed something. No, do you think so?
Well, I think it is a draining. Yes, it's
what?
a kind of a draining to cultivate stillness and openness, and also it turns you into, I think, a little bit a better person. But
so
my
too.
Point is, my point where I want to end up is at the end of the session, when you come back home, then the energy of the rest is there, and I find that sometimes quite strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to ask you how to deal with this shadow energy, because here everything is extremely beautiful, but at home it's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, at least. And so then the energy maybe of the aggression or other things can be very intensive. And I'd like to ask you how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a very good question, Ulrika. It's something that I do remember very well. From you go on a retreat, you sit together, you know, something is happening. You know, as I said in the beginning, you feel something is going on, and more and more, even in the singing, you hear the one voice is coming, the one body, and the connection, and there is a lot of love, and, you know, this. And then we go home. Then first I went through my post-Sesshin blues, you know, the leaving and coming home and this. But sometimes you could still feel the energy, like in your body and in your belly, of the presence or the concentration. For me, something changed actually in the moment I started living in the center, because we did Sesshin there. But I did not have to go back home, because my home was there. So the blues kind of disappeared, because I could stay there. You see, that was... And due to that, actually, I realized there is this, for me, what I think for me was true is, you know, there is a kind of build-up of presence, of somatic presence, somatic energy, and the sitting and the samadhi, the concentration, the presence. And I noticed I can't hold on to that. It kind of leaks away. It leaks away. And it made me feel sad, because I felt like the power of the retreat kind of disappeared. But in due time, I realized that actually under the samadhi power, under that kind of energy of the retreat, something else was also alive. Something else of kind of, what you could call a kind of inner stillness somehow, or an openness that was touched upon. And over time, I kind of, in a way, I let leak away the power of concentration, but I could kind of nourish a little bit this stillness or heart opening a little bit. And so in a way that worked for me. So it became less kind of this, less. It's still there to a certain degree. But I think it's not a problem so much now. You see? Because with this underlying quality, we deal in the heart of our life. We try to work with that.
Amy told us after our first retreat with her to be gentle with ourselves after the retreat.
I have the impression that the ego wants to overtake power again and show who's the boss, and that's maybe comes from that quality.
You know, Ulrike, I consciously, like 10 years ago, I stopped using the word ego. You know, I'm just, because I noticed in Sangha and in the exchange, the word has so many, so much weight, has such a bad connotation in a way. I like to talk about the narrow self and the wider self.
Yeah.
You know, even in Buddhism, they say there is no really a fixed ego. But sometimes we have a sense of being contracted, you know, the way we experience our being, and sometimes we are a little open. And maybe it's not so much a point to, you know, often we have the sense of being stuck in this contractedness. And on retreat we can open up, or, you know, but maybe it's not the point to reach a state where we always open, but that we can relate to being open sometimes and sometimes being more restricted. That the mastery is in dealing with sometimes being open and dealing with sometimes being closed and learning from that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of wanting one thing instead of the other. Where are you from, Ulrike, in Germany?
From Dresden, from the east.
Dresden.
In Germany, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Seu.
Portuguese name.
Yes.
Yes.
Sky.
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 Sky. Wow.
Sky. Yes. I think after the retreats, after we become more and more structured.
More and more
a structure that stay in us when we sit the next morning, after we have this, and the next days, the day after the retreat, I feel the people, I feel the bodies, I feel some days. I feel this energy with me. It's a beautiful experience, and I feel that it's a memory. It's something that stays on me.
Yeah. You know, and I think a recollection, a memory, is a powerful thing to practice with. You know, even the memory of a retreat, of an atmosphere, like sometimes in the sitting we can, in a way, reconnect to that somehow, sometimes, I think. but maybe, but first, Amy Roshi, you know, in your study, when you told me, when we do Zoom, on the wall of your study is this drawing, this Flemish word, yes, ja.
You made.
Yeah. And Amy told me, ja, in Portuguese means?
Now.
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 Right. I thought it's so now.
No.
So beautiful. I mean, I had no clue, but, you know, when we say really yes, we're actually in the now. And being in the now, we say really yes to this moment. I think it's very interesting. But I want to maybe add something to what you say, to what came up for the recollection. in the springtime, I guess it was April or May, so one morning I woke up at home. I don't know, I hadn't done something special, but I woke up and it was early morning, really like 4 o'clock or something. And there was, I noticed there was like a sense of contentment. And it was really unusual because think by nature, I don't have often the sense of contentment. But that morning, waking up, I was really like, You know, it has also to see, I think we, you know, with the corona, we had a special year, but also in the Sangha last year, we had really like a difficult time, like growing up time. There were painful things happened in the Sangha, also for me. So it was a year of reflection and healing and restoring, and also of saying goodbye to some people. Some people left. So it's been a difficult year in a way. But things are better. I think things are better, and we're working, and people come, and we're doing fine. Anyway, but that morning I noticed I felt like a sense of contentment. And a contentment, you know, I'm living in it's an old house, but I like it. It's near the canal in Ghent. We have a lot of space. We have a large sangha building that we can use. You know, I think we have a happy time with the family. We go along well. My daughters are growing up healthy. They're good girls. They enjoy going to school. And I'm doing something that I enjoy very much, you know, in my life. And I realized that there's quite a lot of things that I can appreciate. I mean, I know this thing. I mean, Mizumi Roshisa, the teacher of my teacher's teacher, has this book, Appreciate Your Life, and we've talked about it and read it. And I know this, but in a way, and I realized that morning that somehow I had only realized it mentally in a way. But that morning there was a sense of really almost a gratefulness. And it really struck me because, again, you know, and even in practice, all those things about metta practice and this and that, I always felt it didn't speak so much to me. But that morning it was just there. And in a way, it colored my day. So afterwards, I decided to use that as an exercise. So every morning, for more than 2 months, upon waking up, I kind of consciously try to appreciate the things in my life. Just this moment. And the recollection of that spontaneous moment, it was a little artificial, but I did notice after a couple of days that something worked. Although it's a kind of something you decide to do. And I did notice that somehow my days were like better doing that in the morning. And I think I became a little Zen. It had like a milding influence in my personality and my behavior. So sometimes I'm saying like recollecting moments on a retreat or an atmosphere, if we bring that in our practice, it really has an effect, I think.
As an addenda to what you're saying, appreciation in those early moments when I'd much rather have a fight with somebody, this last year and however long, what has really made that possible for me is our getting together on Zoom every morning. I have something to look forward to. I'm going to have good company. I have little things I have to get done before. I have to have a little coffee, a little exercise and everything. It's been so major, really, in my life that every Tuesday to Friday, whether or not I have the time to have a fight with somebody, we're going to get together. You know what I'm saying? It's just been so, well, we said it to each other on the screen, but I want to make it official. It's really been enormous to me, changing that wake-up moment, going into something Absolutely. That I know I'm going to appreciate. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you, Debbie.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.